Imagine walking up to an incredibly exclusive nightclub. You know, you've got your ID, you're dressed to the nines, your record is spotless.
And you've got plenty of cash in hand.
Exactly. Cash in hand. You are the perfect patron. But the bouncer just looks you up and down, checks his little clipboard, and turns you away.
Yeah, and not because you actually did anything wrong.
Right. Just because, I don't know, someone else with your exact same profile got there like 10 seconds before you did. And now, since February of 2026, this exact scenario is playing out thousands of times a week in the Australian housing market.
It really is. It's completely upended the traditional logic of lending.
Which is wild to watch. Perfectly flawless mortgage applications are just bouncing back, declined, and people are losing their minds trying to figure out why.
Because we're so used to this binary system, you know,
Yeah.
where the math either works or it doesn't. You have the income, you have the deposit, you pass the
You
test.
get the house.
Right. But what you're describing with that whole nightclub scenario, it's a structural shift. We've moved from a merit-based approval to a capacity-based approval.
Which is exactly why we are jumping into this today. If you're listening to this right now, whether you're a mortgage broker staring at just a pipeline of inexplicably stalled files, or you're just someone fascinated by the hidden mechanics of how money actually moves through the economy, we are going to unpack the invisible wall these loans are hitting.
Yeah, we really need to demystify this.
Our single source for this deep dive today is a highly tactical piece from the Broker Times. It's by Jennifer Austin, and it's titled The 20% Speed Limit: How APRA's New DTI Cap Rations Your High Debt Files.
It's such a vital piece of industry intelligence,
Yeah.
mostly because it stops treating these declines as individual failures, you know, and it starts looking at them as a systemic logistical reality.
Exactly. So our mission today is to figure out what changed in February 2026, explain how the lenders are essentially rigging the door to that nightclub, and then build out the specific sequencing playbook you need to maneuver around it.
Because the rules of the game have completely changed.
I really have. It's no longer just about your borrower's financials. It is heavily, heavily about timing.
So to understand the timing, I mean, we have to look at the rule itself. So the Australian Prudential Regulation Authority, APRA, they implemented this macroprudential update for ADIs.
And ADIs, just to clarify, those are the authorized deposit-taking institutions, basically the regulated banks, right?
Yeah, exactly, the regulated banks. So APRA mandated that these banks must cap their new residential mortgage lending at a debt-to-income ratio, a DTI of 6 or above.
Okay.
And that cap is a strict maximum of 20% of all their new lending.
So let me get this straight. For every five new loans a bank writes, only one of them is legally allowed to have a debt-to-income ratio of 6 times or higher.
Correct. Just 1 in 5. But it gets trickier because they also have to apply this 20% limit separately to their owner-occupier books and their investor books.
Oh, wow. So going back to the nightclub, we actually have two separate nightclubs with two completely different lines out the door.
That's a great way to look at it. Two different quotas entirely. Now, to understand why this feels so incredibly restrictive on the ground, you really have to look at what APRA didn't change.
Okay, what didn't they change?
They left the 3% serviceability buffer entirely untouched. And this is, even though we've been sitting in this 4.35% cash rate cycle for a while.
Wait, just so we are all on the exact same page mechanically here, when you say a 3% serviceability buffer over a 4.35% cash rate, you mean the bank is already stress testing if the borrower can survive a 7.35% interest rate on their mortgage, right?
Yes, exactly. Plus, whatever extra margin the bank adds on top. So, in reality, you might be tested at around 8% or even more.
Okay, so if the banks are already testing people at these massive hypothetical interest rates just to make sure they can afford the loan, why did APRA feel the need to drop this new 20% DTI quota on top of it? I mean, isn't the serviceability buffer enough to stop people from overborrowing?
Well, it's about dual-layer protection. The serviceability buffer, that protects the borrower from an immediate interest rate shock, like if rates jump up tomorrow.
Right.
But APRA is looking at systemic long-term risk across the entire economy. I mean, household debt in Australia is heavily elevated right now.
Extremely elevated, yeah.
And APRA expects that when the rate cycle eventually turns and rates start dropping, credit growth is going to accelerate rapidly. People will want to borrow more.
Ah, I see.
So by capping the volume of high DTI loans now, they're trying to limit the overall buildup of highly leveraged debt before that borrowing frenzy even begins.
So they want to fix the roof while the sun is still out.
Exactly. They're trying to stop people from maxing themselves out to the absolute limit. This way, if there's an income shock down the road, these borrowers actually have some financial headroom left.
That makes a lot of sense from a macroeconomic theory standpoint. But on the ground, you know, at the actual bank level, the reality of implementing a 20% portfolio quota sounds incredibly messy.
Oh, it's chaotic. Let's go back to your nightclub analogy because it's perfect here.
Yeah.
When you first read 20% cap, your brain naturally assumes it's a test the borrower's failing, but it's not.
No, because a DTI of 6.2 isn't a failed background check. The bouncer isn't looking at your ID and saying, you aren't bankable.
Right. The bouncer's looking at a little mechanical clicker in his hand, realizing he just hit the strict fire code limit for the VIP room.
And he's just saying, look, you are a great customer, but I legally cannot let you into this room right now.
And to take that analogy a step further, the bouncer isn't just looking at the room's current capacity. They are looking at the line of people wrapping around the block out back.
Oh, man.
A bank isn't assessing one loan at a time. They're managing a multi-billion dollar pipeline of pending applications. So they have to actively forecast if they are going to breach that 20% limit weeks, sometimes months in advance.
Which means the banks have to actively manage the door to the club. And according to this piece in the Broker Times, this is creating some wild, unpredictable behavior that brokers are having to somehow explain to their clients.
Yeah, the source outlines three distinct operational reactions from the lenders.
Okay, what's the first one?
The first is straight policy tightening. So some lenders look at that 20% threshold and decide it's just too risky to even get close to it.
They just don't want to play the game.
Right. So they lower their maximum allowable DTI outright, or they introduce severe policy overlays.
Overlays like demanding a much larger cash deposit or refusing to waive certain conditions if the DTI is over 6.
Yes. They just make the door physically narrower so fewer people can fit through. It's a blunt instrument, but you know, it's transparent. You know up front if you fit the policy or not.
Okay, that makes sense. But what about the lenders who try to manage it dynamically?
Well, that's the second reaction, and it is much more volatile. We call it period-end rationing.
Period-end rationing.
Yeah. Some lenders decide to play it close to the chest. They lend normally for most of their reporting quarter, but as that 20% quota starts filling up, their internal risk dashboards start flashing red.
And they panic.
Exactly. They suddenly pull the handbrake.
Hold on. I want to really dig into this because the implications are maddening. You're telling me that an identical borrower, same income, same deposit, same exact financial footprint, could sail through assessment and get approved in week 2 of a reporting quarter.
Yes.
But that same borrower would get a hard decline in week 11 just because the bank's internal bucket filled up.
That is precisely what is happening on the ground right now. At week 11, the credit assessment engines at the bank are essentially told to look for any excuse, literally any excuse, to say no to a high DTI file.
How does a broker sit across the desk from a family and explain that? Sorry, guys, your finances are immaculate, but it's late November, so you can't have the house.
It's terrible.
It makes the broker look completely incompetent, even though they have zero control over the bank's internal reporting calendar.
And that is the immense frustration driving the industry right now. A DTI-driven decline looks and feels like a client problem. It feels personal.
Yeah.
But in reality, it's a timing and capacity problem.
Yeah.
The file was submitted to the wrong lender in the wrong week.
Unbelievable. Okay, so what's the third way banks are managing the door?
Repricing. Rather than giving a hard no or messing with quotas, a few lenders keep the high DTI window completely open, but they use the interest rate as the throttle.
Ah, I see where this is going.
Yeah, they algorithmically increase the margin on files with the DPI over 6.
So they are basically saying, sure, you can come into the VIP room, but the cover charge for you is now $10,000.
Pretty much. They make the loan so uncompetitive that the broker is essentially forced to recommend against it.
It's a classic market mechanism. They politely price you out of the market to protect their internal capacity without ever officially declining your application.
Exactly. So the invisible wall is real, and the bouncers are using policy overlays, period-end rationing, and aggressive repricing to keep the numbers down.
But who are they actually turning away? I mean, who is taking up all the space in this 20% bucket to begin with?
The article identifies three very predictable groups of borrowers who are constantly hitting this cap. The first, and honestly the most severely impacted, are investor borrowers.
Right, because earlier we mentioned that APRA forced the banks to create two completely separate quotas.
Yeah.
One for owner-occupiers and one for investors.
Yeah, and the investor bucket fills up much, much faster.
Yeah.
Because property investors structurally skew toward higher leverage. I mean, they use debt to acquire assets. That's the whole point.
Right. That's the business model.
So an investor sitting at a 6.5 DTI is fighting for oxygen in a much smaller, far more congested pool than an owner-occupier at that exact same ratio.
That makes total sense. Okay. Who is the second group crashing into the wall?
Metro borrowers with existing debt. We're talking primarily about buyers in Sydney and Melbourne, where property prices are just so detached from median incomes.
Oh, absolutely.
Even high earners are instantly pushed into that 6x territory just to buy an entry-level home.
Just having a Sydney postcode practically guarantees you a high DTI.
It really does.
Yeah.
And if you add in any sort of existing structural debt, it's an automatic flag. The article specifically calls out things like a previous mortgage, a car loan, or even a HECS debt.
Ah, right. For our listeners outside Australia, HECS is the Federal Higher Education Loan Program. It's essentially a government student loan.
Yeah.
And it used to just be an annoyance that reduced your net take-home pay. But now, because the banks have to calculate your gross total debt against your gross income, that 40 grand student loan suddenly acts as this massive deadweight, pushing your DTI closer to that danger zone.
Exactly. It's no longer just about cash flow. It's about the sheer mathematical ratio of total debt. Mm. Which brings us to the third group and perhaps the most heavily impacted expanding debt refinancers.
Oh man, this is the one where the irony is just painful to watch.
It really is. The context here is that overall refinance volumes are up across the market. People are looking for better rates.
Yeah.
But a significant portion of these aren't simple dollar-for-dollar refinances. Clients are using the refinance to consolidate expensive credit card debt or maybe pull out a bit of equity for a renovation.
Right. And they are doing this to be financially responsible. They're trying to consolidate high interest debt into a lower interest mortgage to improve their monthly cash flow.
Exactly.
But the second they add even a fraction of new debt onto the pile, their gross debt to income ratio ticks over a 6. They take what should be a routine, responsible financial maneuver and accidentally turn themselves into a heavily rationed red flagged file.
It's a trap. A client who just wants an extra $20,000 to fix a leaking roof suddenly finds themselves fighting for a spot in that heavily guarded 20% bucket.
Okay, so we've mapped the battlefield. We know what APRA's rule is, we know how lenders are reacting, and we know exactly which clients are most likely to trigger a decline.
Yep.
But since a broker can't exactly call the head of APRA and ask them to change the speed limit, they have to change how they route their files.
They do.
The article lays out a 6-step sequencing playbook, but honestly, reading through it, it feels less like a checklist and more like a total shift in how a broker actually operates.
It is a fundamental workflow shift. The immediate first move has to be scoring the DTI at the very beginning of the relationship.
Like before they even find a property.
Exactly. Do not wait while you are assembling the application. Calculate total gross debt divided by gross income in the very first client interview. The article suggests using 5.5 as your internal tripwire.
Because a 5.5 is just a stiff breeze away from a 6.
Exactly.
If the bank assesses their income slightly lower than you did or, you know, shades their rental income down, a 5.5 instantly becomes a 6.1 and you crash into the wall.
That happens all the time. So once you've identified a file as high DTI, you have to map the lender's appetite. You cannot rely on a spreadsheet from 3 months ago.
Right.
You need to know which lenders actually have headroom in their 20% bucket this week. The source advises brokers to interrogate their BDMs, their business development managers at the banks.
Okay, I have to push back on the reality of that, though. A BDM's entire job is to bring loan volume into the bank. Are they actually going to sit there and honestly tell a broker, hey, my bucket is full, don't send me this $1 million loan, send it to my competitor? That feels incredibly naive.
Well, it's a valid skepticism. A BDM might not give you a direct no, but a good broker learns to read the signals.
What kind of signals?
If a BDM suddenly starts emphasizing that high DTI files are seeing extended SLA times or requiring senior credit sign-off.
That is
industry code for our bucket is full and this is going to be a nightmare.
Which means you basically have to act like an air traffic controller. You used to be a financial matchmaker. You'd find the borrower, find the right product, and let the magic happen.
Right.
Now you are literally looking at radar screens, checking runway capacity at different airports, and scheduling exactly when a plane is allowed to land.
The air traffic control analogy is perfect for the next phase of the playbook, lodging early in the reporting period.
Oh, because of the rationing we talked about earlier?
Yes. If you know a bank manages its quota on a quarterly basis, You want to land your plane in week one or two of that quarter when the bucket is totally empty and the credit assessors are relaxed.
But what if the runway is full everywhere? Or, you know, the plane is just too heavy? What's the active strategy to fix the file itself?
You have to forcibly reduce the DTI before you submit. Brokers need a toolkit for this. It might mean telling the client to permanently close down undrawn credit card limits.
Let's explore the math on that, actually. Why does an empty credit card matter if I don't owe any money on it?
Because APRA's rule is about potential total debt. Mm. If you have a credit card with a $20,000 limit, but a zero balance,
the bank doesn't care that it's zero.
No, the bank still has to assume you could max that card out tomorrow. That $20,000 gets added to your total gross debt in the DTI calculation.
Wow.
So by officially closing that empty account, you evaporate $20,000 from the numerator of your DTI equation.
So clearing an unused card or aggressively paying down a small personal loan might be the exact mathematical maneuver that pulls a borrower from a 6.1 DTI down to a 5.9.
Exactly.
And suddenly, they aren't in the VIT line anymore. They're just a normal customer walking through the front door. The 20% rule doesn't even apply to them.
That is the most elegant solution. But if you can't get under the limit, the playbook insists you must have a fully structured fallback lender ready before you launch the first application.
Right, a plan B.
Yeah, because if you hit a capacity decline, if the runway suddenly closes while you are on approach, you want that pivot to cost you one afternoon of admin, not 2 weeks of panic scrambling while the client's finance clause expires.
And obviously, you have to tell the client this up front. Setting expectations that a high leverage file might require a multi-stage strategy is way better than calling them 2 weeks later with a surprise rejection.
Transparency is non-negotiable.
Okay, so as an air traffic controller, I'm feeling pretty good. I'm checking runway capacities, I'm delaying flights to hit the start of the new quarter, I'm closing credit cards to make the planes lighter. I am a logistical genius.
You are.
But as I'm doing all this maneuvering, I can't shake the feeling that I am steering myself straight into a massive legal trap.
You are, and this is the most critical insight in the entire article.
Mm.
This logistical maneuvering collides violently with a broker's best interest duty, or BID.
Best interests duty. The strict legal obligation in Australia that mandates a broker must always act in the best financial interest of the consumer.
Yes. And here is the trap Jennifer Austin outlines.
Mm.
Just because a lender has room in the bucket to approve a file this week does not inherently mean that specific loan is the best option for your client.
Oh, man.
And ASIC, the corporate regulator, is actively monitoring this behavior.
Wait, so if I have a client who needs to buy a house and Bank A has a great interest rate, but their DTI bucket is totally full, I can't send them there. So I route the file to Bank B, who has plenty of room, but their interest rate is, say, 15 basis points higher. I've solved the logistical puzzle and gotten the client the house. But legally, I might be breaking the law by prioritizing a fast approval over a cheaper rate.
That is exactly the tension. Who has the capacity to approve this right now is quietly masquerading as what is in the client's best interest. And those are fundamentally different things.
That is terrifying. How does a broker survive that compliance trap without losing their license?
It all comes down to aggressive, precise documentation. Your file notes must separate the suitability of the loan from the logistics of the capacity.
Okay, break that down for me.
You have to explicitly prove why that specific lender's product features, structure, and cost are appropriate for the client's goals. The fact that they were the only bank with an open runway cannot be the core justification for why you recommended them.
So I can't just write in my compliance notes, I put them with Bank B because Bank A's bouncer wouldn't let us in. I have to prove that Bank B was actually a sound financial choice regardless of the quota.
Correct. You have to document the trade-off. Something like, we discussed Bank A's lower rate, but due to severe capacity constraints and the client's strict settlement deadline, the client elected to proceed with Bank B to ensure funding.
Ah, okay.
You have to evidence that you had that exact conversation.
Let me throw one more variable at you. We've been talking entirely about ADIs. Mm. The highly regulated banks subject to APRA. What about the alternative sector?
You mean the non-banks?
Yeah, the non-banks. They aren't ADIs. Can't brokers just bypass this entire headache and route all these high DTI loans over to the non-bank runways where the speed limit doesn't apply?
It is deeply tempting to view the non-banks as a magical escape hatch. But the reality is much more constrained.
Yeah.
Non-banks do not sit on piles of their own cash.
Right.
They rely heavily on warehouse funding.
They get their money from the major banks and massive institutional investors.
Exactly. And the people supplying that wholesale money have the exact same risk appetites and regulatory pressures as APRA.
Of course they do.
They impose strict covenants on the non-banks. So the invisible hand of the market forces the non-banks to behave almost identically to the regulated sector.
Mm.
They might have a tiny fraction more flexibility on the margins, but they are absolutely not an unlimited release valve for every highly leveraged borrower in the country.
So the risk aversion just infects the entire ecosystem. Wow. If you are listening to this and mapping out your strategy for the week, the mandate from today's deep dive is incredibly clear. APRA's 20% DTI speed limit has fundamentally transformed high debt lending from a simple math equation into a high-stakes logistical puzzle.
It really has.
A decline file is no longer a reflection of a bad borrower. It is often just a symptom of bad timing.
And the actionable advice right now is to pull your active pipeline today. Identify every single file sitting at a 5.5 DTI or higher and treat it as a watchlist file.
Be proactive.
Remap the current overlays for your primary lenders because last month's policy is already obsolete. And above all, audit your file notes to ensure you are legally proving the suitability of the loan, not just celebrating the fact that you found a lender with room in their bucket.
It's all about showing your work and proving you acted in the client's best interest. But as we wrap up, I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over, looking at the macro picture. We just established that because of warehouse funding pressures, even the unregulated non-banks are being forced to close their doors to high-leverage borrowers.
Yeah.
If the entire financial system, both regulated and unregulated, is structurally mandated to turn away 80% of highly leveraged applicants, regardless of how flawless their credit history or repayment capacity is, where does the complex borrower go in 2027 and beyond?
That's the million-dollar question.
Right. If the bouncer at the VIP room is just permanently turning people away based on a rigid portfolio quota, are we slowly, quietly engineering a real estate market where the only way to borrow money is to already be incredibly wealthy?
It's a profound tension. We are prioritizing the systemic safety of the banking sector, but the direct casualty of that safety might be everyday access to credit for upwardly mobile people.
It really makes you wonder who the financial system is actually being optimized for. Think about that the next time a perfectly good file bounces back across your desk. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. We'll catch you next time.